Fall 1975, Bruce Hall, home of grace and culture. I settled in for the first of 5 3-day bus rides between Boston and Denton, armed with my little Bhagavad Gita and a film canister full of marijuana, which was the custom at the time. I took a banana, dipped it in the oregano, and munched it down en route as required. Hare Krishna, Hare Rama, Hare Ganja. I was cutting way back, tripping once a year and smoking maybe once every couple of weeks. But Mary Jane was good to have on the bus. For the fall semester, I moved to Bruce Hall, the dorm where most musicians and many artists lived. This was a great boon for a person with my distinct social difficulties. I had every opportunity to establish some kind of relationship with one of the many intelligent, creative, and attractive women living there. We shall see how well I fared. By this time, I had been without a haircut for almost 4 years, and my hair trimmed itself by attrition. This was couture of inattention, not maintenance, and it would have been dreadlocks had my hair not been extremely fine and occasionally laundered. When too clean, strands would drift up and get between my bow and the string, causing mayhem. But if long hair was good enough for Yogananda, it was good enough for me. One of the first things I did was to help paint a large mural on a wall in the basement. My part, predictably enough, was a blue Krishna with flowing black hair stretching many feet left and right. A transfer sophomore named Jonathan moved in a couple of doors down from me. He was a very fine pianist, but was concentrating on conducting. Story was that he was a protege of Anschel's, but I don't know if that was true. He sure knew the political side of things that I had so sorely neglected. His motto was, "It's not what you know, it's who you know," and he allocated his time and efforts accordingly. He did have good conducting skills, and I became interested in getting into Anschel's graduate-level conducting class, even though that would strain my other studies considerably. We were going to play Stravinsky's Rite of Spring during the next semester. To get into the class, I would have to be able to pass a test where I'd conduct any part of the piece while Anschel and various grad students sang the parts. We spent many evenings together carefully rehearsing how Anschel planned to beat each measure, and I played every note written for all 120 musicians on the piano, line by line. I grew to loathe transposition and vowed that all of my scores would be in C. To get in the mood to conduct Texas style, I decided I needed a baton holster. A Vietnam vet who at one time smuggled bales of Thai cannabis in the tails of B-52s lived a few doors down the hallway. He was quite skilled in leatherwork. I got some leather and cut and stitched it into shape. He had all the tools and made elaborate stampings, and we put on a touch of leather stain for that authentic Western look. The result was superb, and I tied it on my right leg, ready for a quick draw for the next 2 years, rain or shine. You never know when there's some conducting to get done, Pilgrim, and I ain't here to win no beauty contest. I met a very interesting bassoonist who was living in Bruce Hall, and we hit it off to a certain extent. She was very intelligent and creative, and I was hoping that we could have some kind of relationship. Our paths crossed from time to time into the mid-80s, but when I told her I loved her, she thought I was an idiot, and that was that. I tried to communicate with her recently, but she avoids contact. The very few times I've tried similar extensions of affection to women, things have gone very badly indeed, so I am extremely wary of doing the same again. It would be less than gallant to go into details, but sometimes I do anyway because, on occasion, I am less than gallant. One side effect of being alone is that when I was about to make a bad decision, there wasn't anyone close to me to tell me that it was a big mistake. Nor did I ever have responsibilities keeping me from taking large and dangerous risks. One fellow denizen of Bruce Hall and my rival in exoticism was Mark Gash. He was born with osteogenesis imperfecta, a severe bone disease that left him in a wheelchair and about 3.5 feet tall. Mark was at the center of the very exotic art scene in Denton. His life was a work of rolling performance art. I asked him to create covers for a couple of my compositions. One was perfectly well-mannered, gently humorous, and quite acceptable. The other was so absurd, obscene, and extremely repugnant that I couldn't resist using it for the variations on the Grosse Fugue, guaranteeing major rejections. Over vacations, he also had to find other lodgings, complicated by his need for assistance in all the daily necessities. I volunteered to take care of him over Christmas vacation, which also gave me a place to stay as I continued my score study. Mark graduated in 1982 and moved to Los Angeles, where he again became an avant-garde icon of sorts, appearing in the movies DOA and To Live and Die in L.A. He died in 2000. I auditioned for Anschel's conducting class, and for my sins, my desire was granted. The strain of taking this class, along with my normal studies, was enormous, but I did manage to carry the full load this spring semester of 1976. The orchestra performed The Rite of Spring and Brahms' First Symphony, also studied by the class. Student conductors got a chance to work with the orchestra for half the rehearsal on Friday afternoons. How much time each student got depended on Anschel's mood and favor, and I got far less time than any other student, about 2 minutes a month. As I was thick-headed, stubborn, and idealistic, I didn't see what this meant. Our final exam was to conduct the end of the rite from memory. All I had to do was channel my 4-year-old self practicing with a dowel and a recording, and all went well. Back north for the summer of spiritual strangeness. In the summer of 1976, Anton introduced me to the Illuminatus trilogy by Robert Shea and Robert Anton Wilson. This was a set of 3 psychedelic science fiction novels heavy on the conspiratorial tongue-in-cheek fantasies. The books were a lot of fun and very well written, but the clearly imaginary order given to discordant events had a disturbing tendency to seem to verify themselves at every turn. It became difficult to separate which was made up and which was real, part of the role good fiction plays anyway, but verging on the dangerous in this case. A good conspiracy theory doesn't need to be based on real intent of some cabal pulling strings. It can rely on real patterns that lie all around us. But working backwards from a pattern, when you have a prime pattern generator in mind ahead of time, is the quickest way to verify a completely wrong idea. Working in science gets a researcher used to the problem. Anton, however, was an anthropology major, which means his whole game was the study of culture-based illusions taken as reality, such as cargo cults, fertility rites, or anthropology departments. I was open to explore possibilities, so we dove into these books for the next couple of years. other readers in Dallas were inspired by the trilogy to start the Church of the Subgenius, which all sentient beings should revere on bended knee. Robert Anton Wilson also wrote a play, Wilhelm Reich in Hell. Anton was impressed by the work of Reich, a crackpot psychiatrist, originally a student of Freud, who ended up living in Maine. Reich was clearly insane himself, which in the psychiatry game is pretty hard to differentiate from normal. A full treatment of his paranoid delusions is beyond the scope of this book, but is entertaining reading and recommended as a cautionary tale. Let's just say, when he thought airplanes flying overhead were from the Air Force coming to give him encouragement, he was a little bit off. Reich put together a complex and incoherent theory based on orgone, which has something in common with prana in some imaginary way. I had plenty of experience with pranayama, which is control of prana by means of breath, so this part of it was of interest to me. His orgone boxes were supposed to collect this life energy, which then could be used therapeutically, as well as odd applications like weather control, shooting down UFOs, and spontaneous generation of microbes. To describe the theory, he made up his own mathematical language, which consisted of a bunch of funny symbols that looked a lot like advanced math to someone who didn't know any advanced math. Anton practiced his Reichian massage on me to try and cut through my body armor by pressing on the tops of my shoulders as hard as he could with his elbows. Hurt like hell, and whatever armor I had remained healthy and strong. It was there for a reason and did its job well. Without it, I would start thinking the airplanes were encouraging me. Although I couldn't buy Reich's approach, I did place great value on trying to make devices that could interact with prana. My many experiences convinced me that this would be the key to bringing transcendental existence into science. I thought it likely that those who had positive experiences with his orgone collectors were getting results without a good understanding of what was happening. It was obvious to me that physical experiment and careful, systematic measurements would be the best route to any kind of accurate overall theory, including prana, consciousness, other planes, and similar matters. Given my level of ignorance, there was no particular reason to think that such important matters as what I was experiencing of the non-physical universe could not be approached in much the same way as finding out about electrons. My budding interest in transcendental physics had begun. Next to Dad's apartment complex was a hill cleared of trees facing west, where I saw many spectacular sunsets. Early one morning, my usual dreams were interrupted by an extremely vivid experience, where I was sitting on this hill as I usually did. But instead of a sunset, a very large earth was slowly sinking to the horizon. The earth looked drab and dark, and much the worse for wear. Once its lower limb touched the horizon, its motion accelerated, and it quickly sank from sight, to be immediately replaced by a rising, brilliantly glowing new earth. But the view of North America wasn't quite the same as what we are used to. Florida wasn't there anymore, and Louisiana seemed also absent. Whatever it was magnificent and completely unexpected. I woke up feeling that I had seen something of deep value, but exactly what it meant was not entirely clear. Kathy, out in Denver, was taking a 4-year break from acting to study metaphysics with a small cult called the Astro Institute, led by the amazingly named Rama Adonis. All the members wore white shawls with the belt tied in a knot on the left side. a knot on the right side would disturb the force field. John and Jackie visited her around this time with disturbing results. She was on a kind of verbal retreat as a nun in her group and couldn't talk to them much at all. That was the last time John saw Kathy, now known as Akanda. The cult was based on the 6-volume Life and Teachings of the Masters of the Far East by Baird T. Spalding. Once again, an incredibly outlandish hoax by a remarkably clumsy con man continues to be taken seriously as a factual account by many spiritual seekers, and the books are sold as non-fiction. He claimed to have been born in several countries at several times, usually England in 1853, but in fact was born in mundane North Cohocton, New York in 1872. In the early 20s, he told his friend David Bruton that he was considering writing a book about a fictional trip to Tibet, and in 1924, he published the first volume of Life and Teachings. He described going through India, Tibet, China, and Persia from 1894 to 1897 with 10 unnamed scientists and meeting Jesus, Buddha, and so forth in the flesh with all the various miracles one would expect. This was an easy hoax to pull off since Tibet was sealed off from outside contact through the whole 19th century, only seeing Westerners after the British invasion of 1903, and precious few then. The general public knew nothing about the real Tibet, so there were and continue to be many imaginary books sold as nonfiction to a gullible audience. Spalding never did actually go to Tibet. He led a tour group to India in 1935, but that fell apart when it was clear he had no clue about the country and lied about having lived there. Equally impossible, he claimed to have invented a camera of past events with Charles Steinmetz, the father of electrical engineering and a very famous person at the time, who conveniently died in 1923 and could not refute the claim. No camera or photographs were ever produced. Although Spalding said he was a millionaire, he died penniless in 1953. 6 months later, his publisher was shot and killed in his Los Angeles office by a jealous husband. David Bruton, a longtime friend of Spalding's, wrote a book describing the hoax soon after Spalding and his publisher died. This had little to no effect on the many believers. Akanda gave copies of the volumes to Grandma, Mom, Dad, and me. I sent mine back as they were just too absurd for my taste. Dad remembered the first volume from the late 20s, when it was still fairly new, and also thought little of the material. A casual internet search will reveal a large flock of believers and little in the way of reality about the books. Akanda took her spiritual life very seriously and was no fool. She was more advanced than I was in these matters. While I thought these books in this cult were bizarre, I was about to go in a much more irrational direction. I visited Ferry Beach each summer, and this time Dad and I were on the staff of a 2-week camp for teenagers. As was my custom, I gave a little concert, this time playing Bartok's First Rhapsody. They had to settle for just the violin part, as the piano accompaniment is quite difficult. Also, for the third time, I produced an underground newspaper, The Daily Mole, which is far too embarrassing to quote. After supper one evening, I took my annual dose of acid. I went down to the beach, took a seat on the dunes, and watched as the horizon, ocean, and beach split in two, so now there was an upper ocean and a lower ocean. Soon, it split again into three. All were equally real. After some time, I decided to go for a walk and had to decide which beach to choose. Being a moderate and reasonable sort, I chose the middle world. I wonder what would have happened had I chosen the upper or lower one. Fortified and stabilized by mantras and pranayama, I stayed on the beach until the early morning hours. The tide went out and fog rolled in, obliterating the boundaries between air, water, and land. Ripples of the ocean continued into ripples of continent. Phosphorescent plankton washed ashore and embedded in the sand, so sheets of light shimmered wherever I put my feet. The wind blew through my empty body. Nobody was home. Senior year, fall 1976. Back to Bruce Hall and a full load plus Brusilov's conducting class. This semester we played Richard Strauss's Der Rosenkavalier Suite over and over and over and over and over until it made me want to retch. I couldn't bear to look at the score and had a very hard time in class. I had a critical flaw as a conductor, much as with my violin performance, in that I was miserably incompetent with music I didn't like. Thankfully, we also did Brahms' second piano concerto. In the first week, I was wheeling Mark Gash past the Bruce lobby, and we spotted coming through the front door a 17-year-old, wide-eyed freshman art major with long blonde hair, just graduated from Plano High School in her first college experience. Fresh meat, thought we, and closed in for the kill. Mark was wearing a tutu at the time, with glitter and a magic wand, and in his naturally munchkin voice shouted, "It's Dorothy! Follow the yellow brick road! Follow the yellow brick road!" while I got on all fours, barking, and circled the poor lass. She immediately saw that she wasn't in Kansas anymore. Thus, for the time being, her pseudonym will be Dorothy. As MTSU was a jocular institution, the homecoming game and election of the homecoming queen was a major event every fall. The queen would have a consort who would ride with her in a convertible in a parade ending at the game. Runners-up would be part of the queen's court. So, in October, I gathered a harem of consorts, and as I didn't care to run for queen, I ran for homecoming phenomenon. Each harem member had a note pinned to her dress, saying, "Official harem member, if lost, return to Bill Robinson." My propaganda covered as much of the campus as I could manage, with pamphlets full of things like, "I'm going to California to write some high C arias," and "Officially embruced by Anschel Dusseldorf." When the student paper asked me why I was running, I replied, "Because I am being chased." Now that's a C-H-A-S-T-E. In the election, out of a field of 15, I did pretty well, coming in second. As a result, I didn't have to kiss President C.C. Jitter Nolan. There was only room for one consort in my convertible in the parade, and the rules required monogamy. I picked Dorothy, decked out in furs, which complemented my dark purple tails with gold trim. Just before the parade, we had a freak snowstorm that left at least 6 inches on the ground. We got to the stadium and threw some snowballs, but the game had to be postponed, alas. It's all downhill from here. While we had a lot of fun, my personal life was in turmoil. The workload was unbearable with Anschel's conducting class, so I dropped all my other courses except for orchestra, violin lessons, and composition. This meant that I would not be able to get my bachelor's degree in the spring when my financial support ended. I saw what the composition graduate students were going through and how unhappy they were. Many wrote music they couldn't bear to listen to because it was the only chance to win composition contests and have a chance at employment. I was burnt out on school after so many intense years of study and 7.5 years in dorms. My studies of macrobiotics made me dissatisfied with the cafeteria food, and I rarely smoked weed anymore, quitting permanently in early January 1977. I started trimming my hair, which got progressively shorter and shorter. I had a falling out with my friend Jonathan after he told me how he met Michael Tilson Thomas backstage, who had no time to see anybody right then. Jonathan said, "Can't you make time for a fellow Yid?" After which they met for an hour. I saw that my political situation in music was impossible. Without powerful friends, money, or ethnic pull, and it all looked quite hopeless. For once, I was right. While Dorothy was quite attractive, intelligent, and extremely creative, our lifestyles were radically different, so a relationship was not going to work. Late in the semester, I became close to E, a chemistry major who was in my homecoming phenomenon harem. For 2 months, I referred to her as my girlfriend. But it turns out I was not exactly correct. She was sleeping with other women. Ouch! In January, she told me to get lost. I saw her again in 1981 at NTSU with a group of extremist Christians handing out flyers titled "Sword of the Lord and the Blood of the Lamb." I tried to be friendly, but she just wanted me to read the literature and get saved. A little later, I ran into her and her partner at the laundromat and tried to speak to her, but she put a newspaper up to her face and pretended I wasn't there. That was as close as I've ever come to a stable relationship, and the only time I've called a woman my girlfriend. I finished the variations on La Grosse Fugue and started preparing my senior recital. Despite our differences, I asked Jonathan to conduct the string quintet. The previous fall, I wrote my second solo violin sonata and dedicated it to Dorothy, who turned 18 that November. I wrote a solo cello piece with my uncle in mind and made a viola arrangement for this recital. Also, as a bit of a challenge to see if it could be done, I wrote a trio for horn, cello, and piano in one day and, oddly enough, called it One Day Trio. In addition to these works, I included Art of the Recorder. Dad was a recorder enthusiast and played every size from soprano to bass with a local group meeting at the Unitarian Church. In the summer of 1975, I wrote a recorder quartet for him and his group. Dad learned every part, but the group would not agree to play it. In hopes of performance, I made many versions, including Art of the Violin, Art of the Saxophone, Art of the Double Reed, and Art of the Flute. None of these were performed. 30 years later, I kept the middle of the three movements intact and wrote completely new first and third movements. Someday it will be performed in this new incarnation, although it has suffered many refusals so far. I'll keep trying, as it is one of my favorite little pieces. I'd had enough of the dorm and looked about for other lodgings at the end of the fall semester. My friend Pat and his girlfriend Tricia rented a big house on the corner of Oak and Fry Street, a block from the school, and there was a derelict garage behind the house. Someone had tried converting the garage to an apartment, but not done very well. The two back rooms had gone back to nature some time ago. The front two rooms had a cracked cement floor, two bare bulbs for light, no water, no bathroom, no kitchen, no storage, no phone, only a mattress for furniture, and no heat. Pat offered it to me for $20 a month plus electricity. I shoveled out the front two rooms and moved in, with two small electric space heaters for warmth in the coldest time of the year. They did not suffice to keep my buckets of water from freezing. There were rumors afoot about previous tenants, of strange visitors and bizarre decorations. I noticed a hexagram from the I Ching on the door. Turns out my macrobiotic mentor, Terence, had been the previous inhabitant. About the strangest thing he did here was to read under an umbrella. The roof did little to protect from the rain. In fact, I could not find a contiguous area free from leaks where I could put my mattress. Thus, I had to sleep under trash bags to repel the ice water melting off the roof. This was not a foolproof option. Water would accumulate in low parts, and when I turned over, it would slosh out over my feet, up my pants legs, as I had to wear all my clothes to bed, and would land in a very tender region in the wee hours of the morning. For furniture, I borrowed a chair, table, and music stand from the school, but the floor was freezing cold, and I needed something to cover it. I found a shopping cart and started off down the street in a hopeful mood. A couple of blocks away, much to my surprise, I found a house that had just burned down, and the result was, lo and behold, carpeting rolled up by the curb. Bingo! So I had my rug for free. From the wreckage, I scavenged boards and bricks for shelving. I bought a kerosene camping stove, which was miserably difficult and dangerous to use, and got my food from Infinity Natural Foods. Even after years of reading macrobiotic literature at the store, I had little idea of what to eat and how to cook. For the first 4 months away from the cafeteria, I boiled rice, soy flakes, burdock, sea salt, and miso all together in an aluminum pot, and ate it with soy sauce and a mixture of miso and tahini. No greens, no surface vegetables, no fruits or nuts, no oil, and certainly no dairy. In addition to cooking with sea salt, I ate a pound of strong dark miso and a pint of old-fashioned tamari soy sauce every 6 days, both being 18% salt. I noticed that my urine turned brown. My kidneys were bleeding. After a little while, I craved sweets and bought jars of honey and ate it straight. For some reason, Terrence and my other macrobiotic friends never told me I was making mistakes. My health suffered under this regime, and I barely had enough energy to get through the day. This did not keep me from lecturing my friends about the wonders of macrobiotics. But as I was clearly not well, people were not impressed. I was no longer taking conducting, but did have classes plus orchestra, and my senior recital loomed. Practicing in my garage was frequently impossible from the cold. I knew things were not going well, so to reset the stage and get some perspective, I dropped acid in March for what I thought would be the last time. It was a very positive experience, which helped me to see what was wrong with my situation. I immediately got out of the garage and moved down Fry Street, only one house away from my birthplace at Flo Hospital. This was also a rough place to live, in a room sharing a kitchen and a bathroom in a large house full of other students, but far superior to the garage. I lived in the back on the ground floor, while the house didn't look too bad from the front. It was a disaster in the back. I gave directions to a friend to visit me there, and he never showed up. When I asked him about it, he said when he got there, he assumed the back of the house had burned down and no one could possibly be living there. I also started eating much more reasonably with less salt, lots of vegetables, sprouts, tofu, and the like. This was still far from a healthy way of life, but at least I could avoid kidney failure and scurvy. However, my weight continued to fall. My recital hit the stage on April 1st. The variations on the Große Fugue proved a bit beyond our grasp technically, and we had to stop and try again, never quite getting it right. In the view of the composition faculty, my skills were lacking, and I failed the recital. Once again, I dropped all but the most essential classes, since the degree was no longer practical. I submitted the variations to Anschel to play with the strings of the orchestra, but he turned it down. In addition, I entered it into a composition contest, and received the most memorable of my many rejections. Rather than a typed original, it was a carbon copy. To avoid the expense of an entire page of paper, the judge had sliced a strip about an inch and a half wide, large enough to contain these words. "Variations on the Große Fugue, eh? Pretty gross. Wasn't the original complicated enough?" So much for 2 years of work. In the 34 years since then, I've entered dozens of contests and have yet to do any better. Wounded, but still maintaining steerageway, I wrote my first orchestral work. Figuring I needed performers who would have reason to want to play a piece, I combined all such political motivations into one package and came up with the Concerto for Neglected Soloists. This was for piccolo, oboe, bassoon, French horn, bass trombone, viola, double bass, and orchestra, and was 12 minutes long. Brusilov ignored it, and no trace of it remains today. The strain of all this and the uncertainty of what came after graduation took its toll. My hair had gotten shorter and shorter under my own scissors, with questionable results. My friend Irene Mitchell, a violin major, most compassionately paid for me to visit a local hair salon to repair the damage. I told the stylist to give me a straightforward, low-maintenance haircut. For my sins, he got all creative on me and gave me a fluffy gay hairdo that required frequent ministrations by a blow dryer to keep the bangs out of my eyes. My scissors had to go to work again so that I could see. With mounting frustration, soon after my recital failure, I crossed the street to where Bill and Ed Sterling lived and had them shave my head. I'll introduce the Sterling brothers in the next chapter. Some people can get away with this, but my skull has a bit of a point to it, and I looked like a freak. The cops checked me out to see if I was an escapee. The Marines paid attention in case I was AWOL, and the Christians assumed I was a Hare Krishna and thus going straight to hell. As my shaving skills were none too good, and I couldn't afford an electric razor, there were nicks and various wounds here and there, leading some to think I had recently undergone brain surgery. Oddly enough, Michio Kushi related other cases in macrobiotics where ill-informed fanatics ate far too much salt and couldn't stand hair. They would throw out their shag rugs, shave their heads, and go on to shave their wife's furs and the family cats. Nice to think I wasn't alone. Showing up to orchestra rehearsal with no hair was one of those singular experiences. Someone back in the wind section said, "He'll do anything for attention," which hit home. He's got a point, thought I, and decided not to be that kind of person. Over time, my life became much less public and eventually reclusive. I wasn't the only one having difficulties. The pianist, who had played my music more than anyone else, and whom I would work with again in the early 80s, had a phobia about dogs. We'll call him Fido. I met him one day as he was getting things out of his locker in the music building and asked him why he was carrying a metal table leg. "That's my doggy beater," he replied with a grin. Now, there was a very lovely, skinny German Shepherd puppy who was a campus favorite, greeting students as they passed by and enjoying the affection and attention we all gave to him. One day, the dog went up to my pianist friend for a little ear scratch, and he beat the dog nearly to death with the table leg. There was a pitiful photograph in the student newspaper of the dog bandaged up and with a sorrowful look in his eye. I heard students saying they wanted to kill this guy. He stayed out of sight for quite some time. Later, Fido invited me to join him to watch a free movie. This was an interesting feature about a hang glider pilot who was photographed landing on top of one of those immense pillars of rock out in Utah that must have been 500 feet high, with about a living room worth of flat area on the summit. But after that spectacular footage, they cut to Billy Graham. The adventure part was just to get a crowd interested in showing up. Fido was trying to convert me to evangelical Christianity. I think the logical first step would be to try not to kill friendly dogs with a metal table leg. Sometimes it is hard to remember that music is supposed to be a healing art. To give myself independence from school, I bought a Fender Rhodes 73-key electric piano for composition, now that I could keep it out of the rain. My first music on this new instrument was my glorious stab at opera. I got temporary, non-exclusive rights to use Eugene Ionesco's The Bald Soprano for the libretto. I'd seen this play at Andover. My poor composition teacher, Newell K. Brown, who had put up with me for 2 years and had seen quite enough, told me there was absolutely no chance of performance of any kind. Shortly thereafter, I saw his point and quit, never to try opera again. I remembered sitting at supper with opera singers at Eastman as they sang quotes to each other and shuddered. What little remained of my hopes for a career in music diminished considerably when one of my fellow students, whose music I thought clearly inferior, was offered a successful career, publication, and performances by a New York agent in return for $200 a month. This was backed up by an impressive list of famous contemporary composers the agent already promoted. Some years later, I noticed this student had remarkable success, many recordings and performances, and tenure. I guess he ponied up the cash. This wasn't an option for me. Peru or Bust, Leaving Denton for Good, Part 2. I had the misfortune of reading exotic spiritual material down at the Infinity Food Store, including Secret of the Andes by Brother Philip. I didn't know that this was a pseudonym for George Hunt Williamson, a UFO contactee from the 1950s and certified nutcase. He claimed that there was a temple in Peru that would be a center for bringing in the New Age with the Brotherhood of the Seven Rays, whatever that was. The book was full of vanished continents like Mu and Lemuria, and a billion-year history with funny-named sages and hidden libraries about to be revealed. I decided to sell my stuff, store what couldn't be sold, and light out for the Peruvian hinterlands for hands-on profit training. For some reason, I figured the best route was via Dad's place in Massachusetts to find some work and get the funds together for the expedition. I left my violin in Anshul's office and stored my piano and a trunk of papers with friends. Sadly, my baton holster and most of my belongings went to the winds. So I asked Dad to spot me one last sum for a car, which, as long as I was in the States, would make me marginally employable. He sent me $400, and I asked my trombonist friend Richard to help me find a car. He took me to a local junkyard, where he found a sedan that would still run, paid $300, kept $100, and I was set. Except, of course, the car kept stalling in difficult places like intersections. I learned how to goose the gas pedal just so to keep it cruising, more or less. At least it was easy to spot with the white oil smoke coming out the back. Unable to afford the gas and oil for the trip, I got a rider to come along. When he saw what I was going to drive 1,800 miles, his jaw dropped, but he figured, well, oh, what the heck. We set off with my single backpack of possessions as I relied on a constant chant of "Om" to keep things running. It worked for 70 miles, which got us into desolate plains. Suddenly, the engine threw a rod and all power stopped. I spun the wheel to get off the highway, and just at that instant, we came to the driveway of a service station. The car stopped precisely in the station's parking lot of its own volition. The manager of the station bought the car for $40, and I called up Terence to come rescue me. My rider stuck out his thumb and hitched the rest of the way, which he figured was the likely outcome from the start. My life was in such turmoil that my signature had changed between the time I bought the car and when I signed over the deed, so that the station manager didn't believe I was the actual owner.